Chapter 3, American Intelligence History at a Glance, From Fake Bakeries to Armed Drones. There is nothing more necessary than good intelligence to frustrate a designing enemy, and nothing that requires greater pains to obtain. George Washington, January 5, 1756. In the summer of 1781, General George Washington tricked the British with a bakery. The deception was part of a huge gamble that would change the outcome of the Revolutionary War. The war had been raging for 6 years. Benedict Arnold, one of Washington's ablest generals, had recently betrayed the cause, switched sides, and tried to hand over the rebels' strategic garrison at West Point. As the Continental Army and allied French forces camped outside of New York, money grew tight and morale was low. Our affairs were then in the most ruinous train imaginable, Washington later wrote. On August 14th, Washington finally received some good news. French naval allies were sailing from the Caribbean toward the Virginia Peninsula. It was the chance he'd been waiting for. At that moment, British forces were split into two large contingents. One occupied New York City under the command of General Henry Clinton. The other, about 7,000 men, led by Lord Cornwallis, had marched south, capturing Charleston and Savannah before landing in Yorktown, Virginia. If Washington could reach Yorktown before British reinforcements from New York arrived, he could defeat Cornwallis and score a decisive victory. It was a big if. Somehow, Washington had to convince General Clinton in New York that the Continental Army was remaining in the area while it was actually marching 200 miles south. In addition to designing fake communications to fall into British hands, Washington decided to go one step further, devising an elaborate deception that included the construction of French bake ovens. Because French bread was a major source of food, bake ovens were a telling indicator of troop movements. Washington ordered that large brick bake ovens be built in Chatham, New Jersey, an ideal stopping point en route to Yorktown, but still close enough to New York to look like it was part of a permanent encampment. Men were dispatched to buy as many bricks for the bake ovens as they could, in the hopes they would be seen by Loyalists and reported to Clinton. Washington even sent a guard unit to protect the construction of the ovens. The bakery started churning out 3,000 loaves a day. Days after the Continental Army left, the ovens were still baking, and the guards were still guarding them to keep up the ruse. It worked. Clinton was convinced that Washington's troops were staying put, even as they headed to Yorktown. Without reinforcements, Cornwallis was forced to surrender in Virginia. It was the last major battle of the war. Espionage has always been part of American history. This chapter briefly traces 250 years of American intelligence, highlighting the major patterns, key events, and intelligence organizations that have influenced the way intelligence operates today. 2.5 centuries may seem like a long time, but the United States is a relative newcomer to intelligence. George Washington's skillful use of espionage during the Revolutionary War came more than 2,000 years after Chinese General Sun Tzu wrote The Art of War, the first book to describe how to use intelligence in warfare. Ivan the Terrible used intelligence to quell dissent in Russia 2 centuries before the American Revolution. French intelligence flourished under the hand of Cardinal Richelieu, who created the first Black Chamber or Cabinet Noir, a government office responsible for intercepting, opening, decrypting, and copying correspondence. Many hallmarks of Britain's modern intelligence system, including its recruitment of promising university students, the close integration of intelligence and statecraft, the use of code-breaking alliances with other nations, and the existence of intelligence leaders who spoke truth to power, date to the reign of Elizabeth I. When British codebreakers at Bletchley Park cracked Hitler's ciphers in World War II, it was the third time in 350 years that British code breaking prevented a foreign invasion. In comparison, America's intelligence history is remarkably short and has been marked by three distinct overarching patterns: halting development, organizational fragmentation, and democratic tensions. Halting development. The development of U.S. intelligence capabilities has evolved in fits and starts, driven largely by wartime necessity and America's evolving role in the world. Until the mid-20th century, intelligence was considered a strictly wartime endeavor, not a peacetime capability to help policymakers gain advantage in international affairs. George Washington's sophisticated intelligence apparatus helped win the Revolution, but did not outlast his presidency. The United States had no permanent intelligence organizations until the 1880s, when the Army and Navy established small units. Even these organizations faced boom and bust cycles, expanding when warfighting necessitated and demobilizing when hostilities ended. It was only after World War II that permanent, robust, peacetime intelligence capabilities took hold. In 1947, Congress passed legislation creating a central intelligence agency to coordinate the activities of different intelligence offices in the military services, the Justice Department, and the State Department. Collectively known as the IC, the United States Intelligence Community, these disparate intelligence organizations have grown in number over time. By 2000, the IC included a dozen federal agencies and an estimated $30 billion budget. Since 9/11, the number of agencies has ballooned to 18, with a new Office of the Director of National Intelligence to oversee and coordinate them all. The growth of U.S. intelligence largely reflects America's changing role in geopolitics. In the 18th and 19th centuries, America was a fledgling nation, separated from Europe by a vast ocean. Geography mattered. Europe was a rough neighborhood with close borders and hostile powers nursing age-old grievances and vying for advantage. America stayed away from great power politics, both because it had to and because it could. Instead, American presidents were focused on national survival, securing their new union from European encroachment and expanding westward by seizing more Native American lands. Thomas Jefferson declared in his first inaugural address that he sought peace, commerce, and honest friendship with all nations, entangling alliances with none. America did not venture abroad in search of monsters to destroy, as John Quincy Adams famously put it in 1821, because it was too busy nation-building at home. As historian David Kennedy notes, isolation represented the most obvious strategic choice for a relatively small, weak state, and one that leveraged the peculiarities of its uniquely insular geography. Aversion to standing armies or permanent intelligence capabilities ran deep. While Americans were willing to fight when necessary in the 19th century and were more than comfortable expanding national power through military force, writes political historian Julian Zelizner, most politicians and citizens were unwilling to commit to a permanent national security state. They would fight a war, and then when it was done, they put away their arms and set their minds to other things. That changed after World War II. Two world wars had left 80 million dead and ravaged the economies and societies of Europe. The Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941 brought the United States into the war, which helped transform the nation from a reluctant global power into an undisputed one. The early post-war years saw the rise of a new international order led by the United States, with new organizations designed to secure the peace, promote prosperity, and spread democratic values. These included the United Nations, alliances such as the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the precursor to the World Trade Organization, and a number of treaties and conventions. At the same time, even before the war ended, U.S. leaders grew concerned that the Soviet Union would spread communism by force, by proxy, and by propaganda throughout Eastern Europe, war-torn Western Europe, and Asia, threatening U.S. allies and interests. As Allied forces met in Yalta in 1945 to frame the new European order, the contours of the post-war world, the devastation of Europe, the economic and military primacy of the United States, and the rising communist threat were already apparent. In 1946, just months after the peace treaty was signed, Winston Churchill delivered his Iron Curtain speech, warning that Europe was fast becoming divided into two spheres, a totalitarian bloc under Moscow's control and free Western democracies. To lead the world in the fight against communism, the United States would need stronger national security organizations and capabilities, including intelligence. As Senator Henry M. Scoop Jackson put it in 1959, organization by itself cannot assure a strategy for victory in the Cold War, but good organization can help, and poor organization can hurt. Fragmented organizations. The second recurring pattern of American intelligence history is organizational fragmentation. Presidents, their advisors, and military commanders have always struggled to coordinate intelligence collection and analysis. In part, coordination challenges are inevitable. Getting the right information in the hands of the right people at the right time is hard, especially when different pieces of intelligence reside in so many different large bureaucracies, each with its own headquarters, workforce, cultures, classification procedures, and competitive inclinations. In part, these coordination challenges reflect the proliferation of intelligence methods, described in Chapter 4, as well as the wide array of intelligence needs of individual decision makers. Specialization has benefits. In the 1880s, the Army and Navy each created their own intelligence units because they had different needs. Today, the National Reconnaissance Office builds and maintains spy satellites. The CIA recruits spies, and the National Security Agency intercepts electronic communications and breaks codes. Those are very different mission sets, requiring tailored skills and capabilities. Specialization also ensures that intelligence customers get the information they most need and want. Good intelligence for the Navy is different from good intelligence for the Army, or the Secretary of Defense, or the President. Even within an organization, intelligence needs vary widely. An infantry officer needs to know whether the road up ahead is still passable. The commanding officer needs to know where the enemy is moving across the battlefield, how fast, and why. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has to understand adversary capabilities and movements across the world, and whether today's battlefield decisions affect America's preparedness elsewhere. Each intelligence agency tailors intelligence for specific customers. Doing so, and doing it well, has its advantages. But the trade-off is that tailored intelligence makes the whole system much harder to coordinate. The danger of fragmentation is that dots don't get connected because they are often collected and then marooned in different parts of the sprawling intelligence community. In 2017, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence reported that 4 million people held security clearances, 1.3 million of which were top secret. There were hundreds of special access programs, or SAPs, requiring clearances above top secret. Information was so compartmented, even senior leaders didn't know about all the programs. There's only one entity in the entire universe that has visibility on all SAPs. That's God, said former Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper. Democratic tensions. The third recurring pattern in American intelligence has been the consistent, uneasy tension between secrecy and democracy, between the need for a government strong enough to provide security, but restrained enough to protect individual rights. Modern-day concerns over NSA surveillance, data privacy, and counterterrorism policies have deep roots. When President Truman signed the law creating the CIA in 1947, he feared creating an American Gestapo, and insisted the new intelligence agency have no domestic intelligence gathering or law enforcement capabilities. More than a century and a half earlier, the framers had also struggled to reconcile the tension between democracy and security. The chief architect of the Constitution, James Madison, was deeply conflicted about how to strike the right balance, going back and forth over the course of his long career about how security should inflect the powers we invest in government, write Benjamin Wittes and Ritika Singh. In Madison's vacillations, we see fascinating harbingers of our own. History, in short, casts a long shadow. The organizational capabilities, challenges, and controversies of today's intelligence agencies are rooted in America's founding debates, the nation's evolving role in the world, and age-old coordination challenges. Revolutionary beginnings. America's founding owes much to intelligence. George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, and other founding fathers are remembered today as virtuous creators of a bold new democracy. But they were also cunning spy masters and manipulators of their information environment, a side of the founding story that has often been overlooked. George Washington's inability to tell a lie is a lie. The cherry tree fable, in which young George admits to his father that he did indeed chop down the tree with his hatchet, was invented by a Washington biographer named Mason Locke Weems in 1806 to boost his book sales. In truth, Washington was an avid spymaster with a talent for deception that would remain unequaled by American presidents for the next 150 years. During the Revolutionary War, Washington had his own secret code number, 711, and made frequent use of ciphers and invisible ink. His extensive network of spies included Paul Revere, the not-so-able Nathan Hale, and the most successful espionage cell of the day, the Culper spy ring of operatives in Long Island, who made secret signals by hanging laundry on clotheslines. Their successes included helping to unmask Benedict Arnold's treachery and preventing the British from ambushing French troops in Rhode Island in 1780, which could have had disastrous consequences. Nathan Hale, America's first fallen spy. In August 1776, British forces drove George Washington's Continental Army out of Long Island. Desperate for information about British troop strength and plans, Washington instructed Colonel Thomas Knowlton to send a spy behind enemy lines. A 21-year-old captain from Connecticut named Nathan Hale courageously volunteered. Hard facts are scant, but evidence suggests the operation was botched from the start. The mission was announced and volunteers solicited in a meeting of several officers. Poor operational security. Hale used his real name and brought his Yale diploma with him, presumably to bolster his cover story that he was an unemployed schoolteacher looking for work. Except that unemployed schoolteachers didn't usually hang around British fortifications. In addition to Hale's flimsy cover, Hale was known to be exceptionally trusting, a poor quality for a spy. Even before he left, Hale discussed the assignment with an old Yale classmate, Captain William Hull, who believed Hale was too honest to lie about anything and tried to talk him out of the mission. Hull was right. A few days after landing in Long Island, Hale made the crucial and amateurish blunder of trusting a stranger who turned out to be British Major Robert Rogers. Pretending to be a fellow colonial spy, Rogers got Hale to confide over dinner in a tavern, then promptly captured him the next morning. Hale was hanged in present-day Midtown Manhattan on September 22, 1776, becoming the first American spy executed in the line of duty. He is famous for allegedly declaring just before his death, "I only regret that I have but one life to lose for my country," though there is substantial doubt about whether he actually said those words. Nevertheless, for 200 years, Hale has been lionized as a symbol of American patriotism, an inept spy but a noble and brave man, As the CIA's Historical Review Program noted, Hale is what he is in the American pantheon, not because of what he did, but because of why he did it. A statue of Nathan Hale stands outside the CIA's headquarters building today. Washington employed all sorts of schemes to protect his forces, confuse his adversaries, and gain advantage. These included filling gunpowder casks with sand to make the British think his munitions were well supplied when they were nearly empty, and writing fictitious reports inflating his troop strength that were designed to fall into the hands of traitors within his own ranks. During the brutal winter of 1777-1778 at Valley Forge, with his troops starving, freezing, and dwindling in number, Washington successfully employed this subterfuge, writing documents referring to phantom infantry and cavalry regiments to convince British General Sir William Howe that the American rebels were too strong to attack. It worked. Had Howe known the truth and pressed his advantage, the Continental Army might not have survived the winter. A ragtag band of patriots defeated the most powerful country in the world because Washington used intelligence to figure out when and where not to fight. It wasn't just Washington who was enamored with deception. Benjamin Franklin waged a covert propaganda campaign from his Paris basement, where he set up a printing press and wrote articles designed to sway opinion across Europe. A printer by trade, Franklin even imported European paper and type to make his documents look more authentic. Some of Franklin's writings were outright lies. In 1777, for example, he wrote a fake letter from a German prince to the commander of mercenary troops fighting with the British in America. The prince complains that he is being cheated out of money owed to him and tells the commander to let wounded soldiers die so the British will pay more. The letter created an uproar in Europe over Britain's use of mercenaries. In 1782, Franklin created a convincing forgery of a Boston newspaper that included fake local news and even fake advertisements. The main story quoted a letter from Captain Samuel Gerrish of the New England Militia, claiming that the British Royal Governor of Canada was paying Indian allies for American scalps, and that many of the scalps sold were from women and children. The story was picked up and used by Whig opponents of the war in Britain. Franklin's use of deception was so skillful, the CIA named him a founding father of American intelligence. Future Supreme Court Justice John Jay led America's first fledgling counterintelligence effort, rooting out Tory sympathizers and spies. His investigative efforts included exposing a British plot to recruit traitors to sabotage American defenses in the New York area, and a plot to recruit George Washington's personal bodyguard to betray the cause and kill the American leader. Future Vice President Aaron Burr volunteered to disguise himself as a priest and travel behind enemy lines in Canada to deliver an urgent request to General Montgomery for reinforcements during the winter of 1775-1776. Early failures. Although America's founders are generally credited with having greater intelligence and deception operations than the British during the war, their intelligence system also suffered from many weaknesses and failures. During this early period, America's intelligence system, from collection to analysis to counterintelligence, was largely a do-it-yourself operation. General Washington frequently served as his own spy master and chief analyst, setting up production for Invisible Ink, advising assets on how to maintain operational security, planting false information for suspected double agents, and assessing the value of the information that came in. Because Washington was enmeshed in running so many intelligence and military operations, he sometimes found it difficult to keep track of everything. In 1777, he wrote to one of his agents, "It runs in my head that I was to correspond with you by a fictitious name. If so, I have forgotten the name and must be reminded of it again." In 1775, Washington ordered a secret paramilitary mission to seize gunpowder stores in Bermuda. The men arrive to find no gunpowder, but several enemy ships. It turns out another American group had already raided the depot, but never told Washington. These kinds of coordination challenges would bedevil American intelligence for the next 2.5 centuries. Washington also experienced his share of outright intelligence failures. Nathan Hale ended his mission empty-handed and at the gallows. The Continental Army's devastating 1777 defeat at Brandywine Creek, which resulted in the deaths of 10% of Washington's force, stemmed in large part from the failure of local militia to detect the English advance. When General Benedict Arnold became a turncoat and joined the British, Washington was stunned by his comrade's treachery. But he should not have been. It was well known that the British were trying to recruit American military commanders. Rumors were swirling that a Patriot general had switched sides. Washington's intelligence chief, Benjamin Talmadge, had received word that there was a highly placed British spy in American ranks. And Arnold, one of Washington's most talented generals, was known to be greatly disgruntled, politically besieged, severely injured, and in financial trouble. He had also recently married Peggy Shippen, the daughter of a well-known Tory sympathizer in Philadelphia. Benjamin Franklin's delegation in Paris was also penetrated by a British secret agent, none other than Franklin's delegation secretary, Edward Bancroft, who transmitted details of Franco-American diplomacy to his handlers in London faster than they reached the U.S. Congress. Bancroft's espionage would not be uncovered until a century later, when secret documents were revealed in a British archive. Nevertheless, on balance, the Patriots' intelligence successes were impressive, particularly for a new nation with so little experience in espionage. After the war ended, as president, George Washington continued to devote significant attention to intelligence, setting a number of important precedents. In 1790, just 3 years after the Constitutional Convention, Congress acknowledged an executive prerogative to conduct intelligence operations and gave President Washington a secret, unvouchered fund for it. In fact, Washington dispatched Gouverneur Morris overseas even before Congress provided the funding, making Morris the first intelligence officer sent abroad under the Constitution. The Secret Intelligence Fund received $40,000 in the first year, but within 2 years the amount had risen to $1 million, or a whopping 12% of the federal budget. To put that into perspective, 12% of the 2019 federal budget would be about $528 billion. Intelligence spending in 2019 was approximately $82 billion. Notably, Congress required the president to certify the sums he spent from that first secret fund, but allowed him to keep secret both the purposes and the recipients of payments. This set a strong precedent of secrecy for protecting sources and methods, or the specific means by which intelligence is acquired. On-again, off-again intelligence. Washington's administration would prove to be an anomaly in the country's early intelligence history. His successors devoted relatively little attention or resources to intelligence. Although sporadic espionage missions continued, the U.S. government did not establish any peacetime intelligence collection or analysis organizations for nearly 100 years following Washington's presidency. Instead, from the late 18th century to the mid-20th century, U.S. intelligence was generally poor, with bursts of action to improve capabilities during wartime, followed by long periods of neglect. Even during wartime, intelligence efforts often fell short. During the War of 1812, military intelligence was so poor that the British threat to Washington, D.C. was not realized until enemy forces were just 16 miles away. On the night of August 24, 1814, as British troops closed in, First Lady Dolly Madison barely had time to rescue the original draft of the Declaration of Independence and Gilbert Stuart's portrait of George Washington hanging in the state dining room. British officers arrived to find the Madisons' dinner and wine left on the table. They ate the meal, then proceeded to torch the house, along with much of the city. When the Civil War began in April 1861, neither the Union nor the Confederacy had any substantial intelligence capabilities. Instead, generals on both sides scrambled to gather information on enemy strength, plans, and troop movements by recruiting spies, monitoring newspapers, interrogating prisoners of war, deserters, and refugees, retrieving documents from corpses on the battlefield, and sending scouts or messengers behind enemy lines. Both sides also invented new intelligence methods. These included using hot air balloons to conduct overhead reconnaissance, presaging the modern-day use of satellites, spy planes, and drones, and pioneering the use of a flag signaling system to communicate from hilltop observation stations over great distances during battle. At the First Battle of Bull Run, a Confederate soldier standing on top of a hill saw something gleaming in the distance. Believing Union troops were attempting a flanking maneuver, he signaled his commanding officer using the wigwag flag system for the first time, and it worked. The Confederates ended up making a surprising show at Bull Run, suggesting the war would not be as short-lived as many expected, and that signals intelligence would remain vital for any and all future warfare. By the war's end, Union intelligence outperformed Confederate intelligence for mundane bureaucratic reasons rather than heroic ones. In the South, various intelligence activities were not coordinated into all-source intelligence. General Robert E. Lee and his predecessor never had a single staff officer devoted to intelligence. Lee and his staff maintained such poor records that enemy organization charts were apparently kept in their heads instead of on paper. The North maintained a similarly fragmented intelligence system for the first 2 years of the war, splintering responsibilities for collection and analysis among various groups. There were balloonists sending reports of troop movements, messenger, telegraph, and intelligence activities conducted by various battlefield commanders at their own discretion, rival Secret Service detective units established by Alan Pinkerton and Lafayette Baker, and even activities directed and paid for by President Lincoln himself. Perhaps most significantly, there was no clearinghouse unit to put pieces together and provide the big picture, an issue that would haunt American intelligence nearly a century later. Each organization sent reports to different people, and coordination was so disjointed that in at least two instances, Pinkerton and Baker operatives arrested or conducted surveillance on each other. In 1863, however, when Major General Joseph Hooker was given command of the Army of the Potomac, he ordered the creation of the Bureau of Military Information, which became the first all-source intelligence since George Washington ran spies during the Revolutionary War. Although coordination was fiercely resisted in some quarters and challenges remained, the Bureau succeeded in producing reports that culled information from a variety of sources. General Ulysses S. Grant found it so useful, he moved the Bureau into his own headquarters at City Point, Virginia, and said that its work enabled him to keep track of every change the enemy makes. Despite its success, the Bureau of Military Information was disbanded after the war. Not until the 1880s did the Navy and Army move to establish permanent intelligence organizations, the Office of Naval Intelligence and MID, or the Military Intelligence Division, later known as the Army's G2. Both of these military intelligence organizations had modest beginnings. The Office of Naval Intelligence began with four officers. The Army's MID had one. Both also experienced boom and bust cycles over the next several decades. They were utilized in the Spanish-American War and World War I, only to be largely demobilized when hostilities ended. In 1908, MID was essentially relegated to providing a map library at the Army War College. By 1916, it had only three people. Then, when World War I erupted in 1917, MID staff ballooned to more than 1,400, and its contingency fund budget hit $2.5 million. By 1919, however, MID's contingency fund fell again to just $225,000. World War I and domestic subversion. In July 1914, the First World War erupted in Europe, with Germany and Austria-Hungary fighting the British, French, and Russians. America tried to remain neutral. Neutrality, however, meant that the United States became an intelligence target for both sides. German intelligence agents orchestrated an elaborate subversion campaign to keep American munitions and materiel from reaching the Allies, while British agents tried to draw the United States into the war. As a result, American intelligence efforts focused on countering foreign espionage activities at home. German plots included using local dock workers to plant time bombs on ships ferrying supplies to the Allies, establishing front companies to purchase explosive ingredients so they could not be used by their enemies to make munitions, and smuggling deadly germs to infect American horses bound for the war. On July 29, 1916, German agents set fire to the Black Tom Island munitions depot in New York Harbor. At the time, it was filled with 2 million tons of war materials bound for Europe, including explosives, weapons, and fuel. The explosion was so large, it severely damaged the main building at Ellis Island, shattered windows across Lower Manhattan in New Jersey, sent shrapnel tearing into the Statue of Liberty, and had the force of a 5.5 earthquake on the Richter scale. People as far away as Maryland felt the ground shake. The British, too, established extensive intelligence operations in the United States that included intercepting and decoding top-secret cables from President Woodrow Wilson and leaking Germany's infamous Zimmermann telegram, which promised a German alliance to Mexico if war broke out between Germany and the United States, to draw the U.S. into the war. Congress passed the Espionage and Sedition Acts to counter espionage and sabotage, laws that since have drawn intense criticism for their infringement on freedom of speech. President Wilson also turned to two law enforcement organizations for help, the Treasury Department's Secret Service and a relatively new organization in the Department of Justice called the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation. The Secret Service had been around for some time. It was founded in 1865 to combat pervasive counterfeiting, though over time its mission evolved. After President William McKinley was assassinated in 1901, the agency assumed responsibilities for protecting the president. When World War I erupted, Wilson directed the Secret Service to investigate foreign espionage inside the United States. The FBI, by contrast, was just a few years old, created by U.S. Attorney General Charles Bonaparte to investigate possible violations of federal laws on U.S. soil. From the beginning, the Secret Service and FBI were rivals. In fact, it was Attorney General Bonaparte's growing frustration over the necessity of borrowing Secret Service agents to investigate the rising wave of crime sweeping the country, agents that answered to the Treasury Secretary instead of him, that led him to begin hiring his own. During the war, the Secret Service and FBI launched uncoordinated, aggressive, and rival campaigns to root out German spies, saboteurs, and immigrants suspected of disloyalty. Justice Department efforts included forming a 250,000-member volunteer vigilante group called the American Protective League, which committed a number of civil liberties abuses while never actually catching a spy. With the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, worries about radicalism grew, and counterintelligence efforts spread to communists, anarchists, and other radicals. It was during this period that the United States launched the first nationwide domestic intelligence program in history. Government officials tapped telephones and opened mail, and in 1919, the FBI began rounding up thousands of people, arresting hundreds, and deporting dozens in what would be dubbed the Palmer Raids, named after Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer. Many of these domestic intelligence activities and arrests later proved to be unfounded, others outright illegal. Although members of Wilson's administration warned that bitter bureaucratic rivalries between the Secret Service and FBI were harming both the effectiveness of counterintelligence and the protection of civil liberties, the president took no action, commenting later that he felt derelict in not having sought a remedy. The president, who championed openness, democracy, and human rights abroad, oversaw widespread surveillance operations and infringement of civil liberties at home. This period, known as the First Red Scare, would be the first of several instances over the coming decades when the FBI would be mired in controversy for overstepping its legal authorities. As counterintelligence efforts proliferated during the 1920s, peacetime foreign intelligence again languished. The Army's codebreaking unit closed after the war, and although the State Department soon created a jointly funded peacetime civilian replacement called, aptly, the Black Chamber, this effort lasted just 10 years and achieved few successes. The Black Chamber's signature achievement was breaking several Japanese codes before the 1921 Washington Navy Conference to negotiate naval disarmament among the great powers. But the Black Chamber was never as adept as its European counterparts, never broke Soviet diplomatic codes, and did not decrypt British, German, or French ciphers after 1921. Instead, the office deteriorated thanks to presidential inattention, budget reductions, reluctance by telegraph companies to share their cable traffic with the government, the Radio Communications Acts, which made radio traffic interception difficult, and opposition from Secretary of State Henry L. Stimson, who believed that spying on diplomatic communications was simply not something that civilized nations did, especially in peacetime. As he famously put it years later, "Gentlemen do not read each other's mail."